Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Mental health experts say the challenges and hardships of the pandemic have elevated the importance of psychological first aid. It's just like first aid for cuts and sprains. Psychological first aid is designed to quickly ease pain and promote healing. Jody Demo-Hodgins is a licensed social worker. She's worked in the field of mental health and addiction for 40 years plus. She is director of the Children's Division at the National Alliance on Mental Illness, Ohio. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Ann. Thanks for inviting me.
The pandemic is different from other traumatic events, such as natural disasters, in the sense that we've lived under a threat of COVID-19 for months, and it just keeps going. Why is this kind of state of limbo so hard to cope with?
Well, it's difficult to cope with because it's kind of a mass event. Everybody's going through it, and you would think that would make it a little bit easier, but the fact that it's just gone on and on for months, and for many people there's been very little change, creates a situation where people start to feel hopeless, and they start to maybe worry a lot more about being isolated and depressed, and they worry that they're not going to get back to a normal state of being anytime soon.
We compared it to psychological first aid, we compared to medical first aid, you know, the Band-Aid kind of approach. Is that, how does it work with psychological first aid?
Well, it works in a similar way, only it requires a little bit more in the way of engaging with people. When you're doing medical first aid, you're rushing in and you're dealing with something that's pretty obvious from the get-go. Somebody may be having a heart attack. Maybe they have a serious cut and you're running in to help with those kinds of things. With psychological first aid, you're noticing some of the things that they're feeling challenged with. Do they seem to be more out of sorts than normal? Are they cutting themselves off from contact with other people? Those kinds of things would require you to then start to try to engage them, make contact with them, and have a discussion. So you're really talking about what you're seeing with that individual as opposed to what injury you're there to try to address or take care of. There are also some assumptions that we make when we see somebody in emotional distress. We may make assumptions about where they're coming from and how that's impacting them. But the truth is we're seeing something from the outside, and we really are required then to ask some questions to find out what's really going on. Because when we start making assumptions about what we think is happening, we're probably going to get some of that wrong or all of it wrong, and that's not really engaging them. That starts with asking questions and responding to those questions with a good, kind, listening ear.
You know, part of the nature of the pandemic is that we're isolated from each other. Even my best friends, I'm only seeing them briefly, socially distanced, every couple weeks. Maybe people aren't the type to want to talk on the phone anyway.
Right.
And also, people often, particularly dealing with depression, they don't volunteer information. That's part of the problem.
Right. They isolate.
Yeah.
So think about ways that you can reach out to them. If they aren't responding to your phone calls or your texts, what other kinds of things might you do? Could you write a card or a note and drop it in the mail to them? Could you, if there are, you know, people are always looking and scrolling through Facebook, could you send them a private message through Facebook to try to engage with them? Could you make an invitation to have a socially distanced visit in their driveway so that you're sitting at one end and they're sitting at the other end? There are a lot of different things you can do, but part of that as a friend requires you to be a little bit more tenacious and maybe push a little bit to get them to at least have a conversation with you. And that it's not going to be easy, especially if it's somebody who is really struggling with depression.
Mm-hmm.
One of the other things I think that can help is just sharing some of the things that you're going through. If you're missing time with friends or family, in the beginning, I was missing time with my grandkids because we were not able to see our four grandchildren.
Mm-hmm.
So FaceTime is one thing, but getting to hold them on your lap, that's a whole different thing. So, you know, engage with somebody and say, I'm really struggling with this right now. I'm missing, you know, going for walks in the community. I'm missing going shopping. I miss my grandkids. I miss going out to lunch. How are you dealing with this? I'm trying to figure out how to do it myself. What's going on with you? And sometimes opening up will give somebody a door into kind of sharing what's happening with them as well.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher, where we're talking about psychological first aid in the age of COVID-19. My guest is Jody DeMohagens. She's director of the Children's Division at the National Alliance on Mental Illness, Ohio. Listeners, if you have a question about this issue, please call us 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. I know that the hardest thing to figure out is when you should intercede, when you should get involved, when you should start asking those questions. So if you're wondering out there, give us a call and Jody DeMohagens can help you. 614-292-8513. This is unprecedented what we're going through, at least in our generations. And probably even if you were to compare it to the, you know, the flu, the 1918 flu outbreak, pandemic, people were more socially isolated anyways back then. We didn't have the social media. We didn't have, you know, the cars, the everything, the way we can fly around and see people and travel and do whatever we want like we do today. And so much, it feels like, I would imagine, a lot more has been taken from our day-to-day lives than was the case in 1918. Of course, it was, you know, killed millions of people and was horrible, but it was different in that way, right? And I'm wondering, there might be some people out there that have never experienced depression, don't even know what the meaning of the word is, that are feeling things they've never felt before. Are you seeing any of that? People just for the first time going, wow.
We are seeing a lot of that, as you may know. And NAMI operates a helpline during the day, every day. And during the pandemic, the NAMI staff has taken a week turn to do the helpline calls. And I know one of the things that I've noticed when I am on the helpline for a full week is the number of people reaching out just saying, I feel like a different person. I feel like I am crying at the drop of a hat. I feel more isolated. I don't know what's going on with me, and I feel like I'm losing it a little bit. And sometimes just telling those folks, gee, you know, I have definitely had days that I'm feeling the same way, and let's talk a little bit more about what your experience is. Are you having trouble sleeping? Have you had a change in your diet? Have you had any contact with your physician, your family doctor, to talk to them about what you're going through? And I think a lot of times people my age, I'm in my mid to late 60s, so people my age may never have thought they would go to a therapist or a counselor or have that conversation with physicians. But I do know that physicians now do seem to be more attuned to asking those questions about isolation and depression. If you've had any telemedicine during this time, even from a doctor that's not a psychiatrist or a psychologist, you're going to get some of those questions. And I think that's really helpful for people. I had one lady tell me that her doctor had asked her and she was embarrassed to say anything. And so we kind of worked out a plan over the phone of how she could call the doctor's office back, ask for another appointment, and then begin sharing with them some of the things that she's been struggling with, because she had also experienced an increase in alcohol consumption, and it was starting to worry her during this time. So
one of those signals that something's up, right? Alcohol, drug.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And if you look at social media, there's a lot of memes and a lot of people joking about, you know, wine o'clock sometime, you know, that every day they're choosing a glass of wine earlier. It used to be 6 o'clock or 7 o'clock with dinner. And now at 2 p.m. or at noon, I can have a glass of wine. So I think, you know, part of what we have to do is just think about how our behavior may have changed and how our use of other methods of coping might have changed, and figure out what might we do to increase our coping skills and use something a little bit less corrosive to get through this, because alcohol use every day is probably not a great idea for most folks. And anybody can develop alcoholism. It doesn't matter how old you are when you start down that path. You can develop alcoholism. So let's think about other ways to increase our coping and decrease some of the distress that we're feeling.
What are some common ways that people think they're helping someone in crisis that can actually make things worse?
Oh, gosh. One of the things that I think we do often is say, oh, I know exactly what you're going through, or I know exactly how you're feeling. You may have an idea of what they're experiencing, but you don't know exactly what they're going through. And we also assume that everybody wants to talk and tell their whole story. People have to find a place where they're comfortable telling what they are comfortable telling. And that probably is not going to be everything that's going on with them. It may be a little piece of it. So, you know, don't make those assumptions and don't patronize somebody. I think it is very patronizing to say, I know exactly how you're feeling, or, you know, I felt that way and I got through it and this is what I did and this is what you need to do. We want to help people figure out what their problem-solving technique is going to be that might help them. And we don't know. We don't know for sure what's going to make a difference for them. So I think those are two things that are really critical. Don't talk down to somebody, and don't just make those assumptions that you know exactly what's going on with them and how they're feeling about the situation.
What does that do when you make an assumption like that? What does that do to the person who is struggling? How does it make them feel?
It's probably going to make them shut down a little bit and close the door or close a window that was opening up when they were starting to share with you. Because as soon as you say, I know what you're going through, it's kind of like going to a funeral and seeing somebody who has just lost a loved one. You may have lost somebody in your life as well, but you don't know exactly what they're going through. You know, that grief experiences are very unique. And so making those assumptions make people feel like you're talking down to them and that you are not really listening to them. Listening is a whole lot harder than we think it is. And it really involves opening our ears and closing our mouth. And not all of us are consistently good at that.
A lot of people have gone out and adopted dogs and cats to fill some of the gaps. And I'm wondering if you've heard from people who feel like, oh, what did I get myself into? It's made things worse, that kind of a thing.
I haven't talked to anybody that's done that. And as I'm talking to you, I have a big old giant dog sleeping on a chair that early on, I found a lot of comfort in just having our dogs here. So I think that's very dependent. If you've never been a pet person and you are suddenly adopting, I always find that humane societies are really good at helping you think through what this is going to mean if you've never had a pet. Never had a cat or a dog. So think a little bit about that. Most humane societies will, at least in my experience, allow you a certain period of time to take the pet back if that doesn't work. And maybe you could be a foster parent to start. So it might be a form of comfort, but doing it as an answer to everything is probably not the right thing to do. You know, each of us has our own tolerance for what comes with being a pet owner, and pets are not the tidiest things in the world. So you have to be willing to put up with some of that as well. But it can really help people feel less isolated.
Elizabeth in Columbus, you're on the air with Jody Demo Hodgins. Welcome, Elizabeth.
Hi, thank you. Hi. Mm-hmm. I wondered if she's ever encountered or has some advice for us when someone is kind of religious. I've seen this in a couple of religions where I encourage people to get counseling or even see a doctor or whatever, and they somehow see seeking help as a lack of faith or weaker faith. And I wondered if she had any advice in that regard, because she would have more authority than I do.
Right. Well, that, Elizabeth, that is a wonderful question. Right now, one of the things that NAMI affiliates around the state of Ohio are doing is trying to create that conversation within the faith community, so that the faith community has a better understanding about mental health issues, especially depression and anxiety, which are the two things that we see most frequently. So as a piece of advice, there are a lot of faith communities, there are a lot of pastors out there who are pastoral counselors as well. So I would look for any kind of individual that might have that as part of their credential. We have several universities in Ohio and small colleges that do pastoral counseling, and maybe try to seek out one of those people. You know, it seems to me that if you look through various pieces of the Bible, there's a lot of reaching out to try to help somebody, and this is just a different way to try to help somebody. So I would encourage somebody that needs help to think about whether or not their faith community has any specific policies around counseling, and if they provide counseling, because there are a lot of churches and there are a lot of private counseling agencies that have pastoral counselors or people that are people rooted in faith that provide therapy as well. So it's a difficult bridge to get over for people. I would maybe check out the library and see what kinds of books and information you might be able to find on counseling from that faith perspective, because there's a lot of good material out there. And if I could be on the phone and go to my basement, I would be able to pull out a few samples. But if you want to email me, Elizabeth, I'll give you some examples of those books. It's really simple. It's Jody, J-O-D-Y, at NAMIOhio.org. So Jody with a Y at NAMIOhio.org, and I will give you some sample materials. I know that the Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services a couple of times has done seminars around getting the faith community to the table to talk about mental health. And look for your local NAMI. Franklin County NAMI is going to be one of the organizations that's going to be creating some links with the faith community to increase their understanding about mental health conditions for all ages.
Jody Demo-Hodgins, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Dan. I always enjoy it. Take care. Have a great day.
You too. Jody Demo-Hodgins is director of the Children's Division at the National Alliance on Mental Illness, Ohio. And we've been talking about psychological first aid in the age of COVID-19. More Wellness Wednesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. In this country, if you're lucky enough to recover from a serious illness, also means that you're unlucky enough to be saddled with massive debt. Unpaid medical bills account for half of the debt owed by American consumers. A 2018 study estimated that $81 billion in medical debt was sent to collection agencies. A new survey by Consumer Reports shows that such debt is also a medical concern for Americans. That is, it can make you sick. Consumer Reports reporter Lisa Gill covers healthcare and medication costs. Her article, "Could Your Medical Bills Make You Sick?" appears in the November issue. Welcome to the show.
Oh, good morning, Ann. Thanks so much for having me on.
People you interviewed for your story are having to make tough choices because of medical debt. And you interviewed Devin Barrington Ward of Georgia. What did he tell you and others like him?
Oh, Devin's story is devastating. Devin is a young man, 30 years old. He started a social justice organization in Atlanta, Georgia, just really within the last like 2.5 years or so. And He was between insurance coverage, and as a small business owner, you know, getting health insurance at age 30 wasn't really his priority. And unfortunately, this January, he got really, really sick while at home. I mean, like debilitating acute illness. And he and his family were trying to decide whether or not he should even call an ambulance to take him to the hospital. He was trying to sort of figure out, like, he was trying to do the math while being really, really struck with a digestive problem. His mom wound up taking him to the emergency room, and after about $10,000 worth of tests and doctor visits, CT scans, and whatnot, he's stuck with a huge medical bill and no insurance and no real way to pay it. So he, this poor young man, really is on the hook for an incredible amount of money, can't resolve it, and is trying to push his business forward. He tells me in the interview, you know, I'm looking to save money to buy a house. I want to start a family. I want to keep my business going. And I have a $10,000 medical debt. And, you know, to be honest, Ann, it's probably going to wind up in not just collections, but on his credit report, which winds up being more problematic when he tries to expand, you know, financially in other ways as well. So Devin's story is really heartbreaking. I'm hopeful that maybe through the power of the story, something good will happen as a result.
His story is heartbreaking, but it's not unusual, right?
Oh, no. And, you know, when I first talked to him, I thought, oh, this is an outlier. This can't really be the case. And the more I spoke with people, I realized it wasn't just people like Devin who don't have health insurance. It's a lot of people who have health insurance coverage who wind up with a medical bill. In fact, in our nationally representative survey, we learned that people that had the highest out-of-pocket cost bill in the last year was a surprise to them. I mean, this, you know, and this is the thing that we really, really thought deeply about is the fact that, you know, the Federal Reserve does these amazing surveys really every year to try to understand how much liquid assets people have. You know, can they cover a $400 bill of any kind in their household? And nearly half of people don't even have $400, you know, lying around to deal, to tackle any kind of surprise financial hit, much less a medical bill. And so, you know, these confluence of events here along with COVID and unemployment, loss of health insurance, sets us up for a pretty serious problem as we move forward.
And the issue with medical debt also intersects with the issue of COVID-19 in terms of who is most affected by it, and that is people of color in this country.
That's right. We learned from our survey actually a couple of really painful things. One was that, you know, people in sort of Black and Hispanic communities told us they were far more worried. We asked questions about, you know, how worried are you about various things, more worried about paying any kind of medical bill, worried about getting any kind of health care, and worried about getting affordable health care. That's the first issue. The second is that they, for reasons not very well understood yet, medical people in Black communities in particular are more likely to have unpaid medical bills. It's about 1 in 3 who have a medical bill in the Black community have not paid it. They are technically late. When you compare that to all other groups together, including whites and Hispanics, it's 1 in 4, which is less common. So it's the unpaid medical bill is a problem. It goes into collections earlier and faster, and it goes on credit reports earlier and faster. And so it's just a terrible cycle.
And then to get the issue of how debt like this can make you sick or sicker, people put off health care when they are underinsured, uninsured, or owe a lot of money.
That's exactly right. Our nationally representative survey showed us that in spades. It showed us that 41% of people that had paid a medical bill out of pocket in the last 12 months, 41% avoided going to the doctor for any subsequent care because of high costs. We also learned that 20% refused to get a test or a procedure or screening test because of cost, and 15% declined filling a prescription drug, you know, a prescription for a drug that their doctor suggested they should have. So we know it very deeply, quickly affects medical decisions. And we also, there was a really, really good survey by Kaiser Family Foundation in 2019 kind of on this topic. And what they found is that 1 in 8 people who delayed medical care because of costs specifically, 1 in 8 told Kaiser Family Foundation that the condition that they had, that they wanted to seek medical care for, had actually worsened as a result of not getting the care. So we know it has an impact. You know, avoiding medical care when you need it can be a really, really risky, dangerous business. And I think that's one of the most sort of prominent, you know, issues really out front.
And it ends up costing us more money.
It does. It does. And it, you know, shows us just like, you know, in the case of Devin, you know, he winds up in an emergency room instead of maybe more regular doctor visits as a result of having health insurance. And, you know, the same issue happens with people that have high deductible health insurance plans. You know, and this is, and those phrases sound sort of like industry jargon, except
yeah.
that, you know, and then they are, except they have a real world meaning. And it's really insurance where you have to pay a boatload of money up front before insurance kicks in. You know, and it's true, like, you know, auto insurance and other things have deductibles. In the case of a high deductible health insurance plan, the minimum for that is $1,400 for an individual and about double that for a family. But we've interviewed people in the course of my career that those deductibles are $5,000, $10,000, and $14,000, and sometimes even higher. It's really criminal. So they avoid medical. There are very interesting studies showing people avoid medical care when they've got to lay out money initially, and that makes people sicker as well.
On page 45 of the November issue of Consumer Reports, you have a very helpful. It's a blue page. And it explains how to fight big medical bills. And it starts with dealing with it right away, because that can affect your credit history right away. So you need to take action, even if it's just notifying them, picking up the phone, calling them, writing them the letter, let them know.
That is exactly, and I cannot emphasize that enough. And even in my own personal life, I mean, I can tell you that when something winds up on your credit report, to fight it takes time, effort, resource, and you have to stay on top of it. And even when you're in the right, even when a mistake has been made or when something has gone awry, it is a real nightmare. And it's really hard to do other things meanwhile. Get an auto loan, student loan, a mortgage, sometimes even rent an apartment. I discovered that with one of the people we interviewed, Nikisha Barnett, was trying to get a two-bedroom apartment for her and her mom, so her mom could move in with her, her mom had dementia. And because of a $1,200 medical bill that accidentally got into collections, it really hurt her credit, and she could not get the apartment. It's, you know, and those things maybe sound small, but, you know, in the actual fabric of your life, they become massive problems. So you're right. The first thing to do is to notify. If you're going to dispute a hospital bill or a bill from a doctor or provider, let them know to not turn it into collections and to put it on hold until it gets resolved.
And you could sometimes negotiate as
well.
Oh,
yeah. So that's the next part. So and there's a good reason to negotiate. I mean, the first thing, too, is, you know, when you first get that medical bill, before you start negotiating, don't pay it. If you're a hospital or doctor sends a bill to you, I know it sounds counterintuitive, don't pay that bill. Wait until it gets sent to the insurance company, and then you receive what's called the explanation of benefits. This is more industry jargon, and I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. You'll see it as EOB. And
we're all familiar with it if you're lucky enough to have insurance.
Right. So it'll show you what you owe. Now, while you're waiting, you still could, of course, call the doctor or call the hospital and let them know that you're waiting. But don't pay it right away. Then the next thing to do, if this is a bill you cannot pay or it's really out of your, you know, it's unaffordable, you need to then ask for an itemized bill. And I'll tell you why. So you won't get an itemized bill. You'll just get a total or maybe just a partial bill. But an itemized bill will show you for every single charge that they levied against you. And what we've learned from the Patient Advocacy Foundation is that, listen to this, half of all medical bills contain some kind of billing error. So you can be double charged for something or charged for something that you never experienced or a doctor that you never saw. I talked to somebody yesterday or 2 days ago. He was billed for hospital stays for nights he was never even there. I mean, the amount of error is just rampant. So do that. Then check if the bill is still high and it clears all the error issues, check the actual prices against healthcarebluebook.org. That is a sort of a public list of prices, everything from a CT scan to an MRI to a hospital stay, and then pick up the phone and start to negotiate with the hospital. Try to bring each charge down, identify any errors that you can, and then, yes, negotiate. And say, you know, you can ask for a payment plan. One piece of sort of financial advice is that we have been told repeatedly that if you offer to pay the full price, which I know not everybody can do that, but if you offer to pay this one-time lump sum payment, you may be able to see savings of about 15% to 20% off the top. So it's worth trying to ask.
I feel like it's really a lot of times people are diminished, you know, after illnesses, that kind of a thing. Or they're doing it for somebody else, you know, who's diminished. And it just feels like we're negotiating a used car price right now and instead of health care. I think a lot of people thought this kind of thing was going to go away.
Right. This long list of tips are intense. And when you're sick and when a loved one is sick and you're dealing with the consequences of that and maybe not even clear what their prognosis is, these steps are super annoying. And the problem is you have to be your own advocate. There are very few groups or people that are going to advocate on your behalf. I will say, when all else fails, but don't hesitate to contact the Patient Advocate Foundation. They are a free nonprofit. They helped some of the people that I spoke with, Patricia Hedgepeth, from a retired school teacher from Michigan. They got a $16,000 bill down to like $2,500.
Oh, wow.
I mean, it took 22 phone calls, mm-hmm. actually probably even more. But, you know, sometimes getting outside help when the billing becomes overwhelming, you know, multiple hospital stays triggers all kinds of bills. If you feel that you're in over your head, contact Patient Advocacy Foundation, or you can also hire an attorney. You know, not everybody has the means to do mm-hmm. that, but it is worth looking into, or a medical advocate. They also can deal with billing.
And,
but I like Patient Advocate Foundation.
And then you can also apply for charitable care. You just depends.
Yes.
You got to find out. There's that you wrote about dollarfor.org.
Yes, that's right. So in the case of like Devin, for example, if you do not have health insurance and you have gone to a hospital either knowingly or unknowingly that must by federal law or federal standards provide some degree of charity care, they have a charitable care program, but they may not tell you. So you have to ask. You can look up dollarfor.org. You can type in which state you live in and try to see which hospitals have charitable care programs. But don't assume they're going to offer it to you. You have to ask. It's typically not an easy process, but dollarfor.org will help you with it, just like Patient Advocacy Foundation will. So don't assume that there's not resources there. They may not make them available to you immediately.
Okay, I'm going to take a quick call right now. Rick in Marysville, you're on the air. Hi, Rick.
Hi. I have a question. I just got a form from Medicaid to reapply, which is normal, and that's fine. But I'm very, very concerned that I might be kicked off Medicaid because I'm receiving PWA unemployment, which was great, but it may put my income above the minimum or the maximum required for Medicaid. So I'm very concerned. Is there nothing I can do?
I heard a lot of these kind of questions popping up. Lisa Gill, what do you recommend?
Yes. Rick, what state are you located in again?
Ohio.
In Ohio.
Ohio, okay. So, Rick, you're very smart and very right to be concerned about this issue. And although I'm not well-versed in the mechanics or the rules and laws of Ohio Medicaid, I can say before you take any action about filling out the forms, and you definitely should obviously re-up if you can, I would call your state Medicaid office and talk with one of the representatives and ask that question directly. They will be able to look at your case specifically, whereas if I give you advice, it's just going to be too general. But I would say that your instinct is correct to just not fill out the form and send it in, you know, out of risk of losing it or perhaps not filling out the form correctly because it's you probably well know, you fill out one form incorrectly, and it can have sort of a cascade of events. So I would hang up the phone now, and I would call your state Medicaid office and just talk through the process. My inclination is that the answer is maybe not so clear-cut. It may not be automatically that you would lose the benefit. It seems like a catch-22 that doesn't make a lot of sense. But my suspicion is that there are probably some very specific COVID-related either forms or process that you'll have to go through. Again, I think your instinct is right. Take action on your behalf. Call them today. And don't be shy about it. Don't wait. And you don't want to have a lapse in coverage.
Okay, Rick, thanks for that call. Thanks for listening. Lisa Gill, thanks for your time today as well. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
Lisa Gill is an investigative reporter for Consumer Reports. She reports on healthcare and medication costs. Her article, Could Your Medical Bills Make You Sick?, appears in the November issue. And we'll give you a link to Consumer Reports on our website at WOSU.org/AllSides. Wellness Wednesday continues, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. When you are president of the United States, you get airlifted to a world-class medical center when you get COVID-19. You have access to drug regimens that the rest of us don't. While President Trump and his medical team continue to report improvement in his condition, some outside medical experts say the drugs prescribed for the president suggest his case may be more severe than they're letting on. We're talking about the drugs, how they work, and what they reveal about the president's road to recovery. And why it matters to the rest of us. Dr. Joe Castaldo is an infectious diseases physician and medical director of infectious diseases for Ohio Health. Welcome to the show.
Good day, Ann. I'm very happy to be here and talk about this.
Some outside medical experts have described the course of treatment the president has received as throwing the kitchen sink at him. And, you know, I was trying to make sense of it myself the other day. And when I figured out that he had also been given a really high-powered steroid, a light went on in my brain because I was given high-powered steroids some years ago when I had the flu and had to travel. And the only way I could do it was to get these steroids. They lasted for about 30 hours. I felt like $1 million. I thought, man, the flu is nothing. And then I hit the brick wall.
Absolutely. And steroids, in addition to what you described, have a whole plethora of side effects.
Yes.
I do want to get everybody up to speed. You know, the president being diagnosed and treated today would have been very different if he was diagnosed in March of 2020 or even earlier, because what we have available now are practice guidelines. We have medicines with some degree of publications and evidence behind them. And this is always a moving target. The science is changing. And now today, there are two national practice guidelines for COVID-19 produced by the National Institute of Health and Infectious Disease Society of America. And as a doctor, as a clinician, we always want to practice evidence-based medicine. And that's where we always have to let the science play out when it comes to treatments, or for that matter, vaccines.
So what did they give him?
Well, let's go through the different medications that President Trump received. And we will start with IV remdesivir. IV remdesivir is not a cure for COVID-19. Remember, Ann, there's two parts of the disease. The first part of the disease has to do strictly, mostly, with viral replication when patients do have a high viral load. IV remdesivir is a medication that inhibits the replication of SARS coronavirus 2. It stops one very important enzyme that's vital for replication of this virus. And studies have shown that remdesivir shortened the recovery time from about 11 days to 15 days. Remdesivir is a medication that is available under emergency use authorization through most hospitals. Here at Ohio Health, and I know Ohio State, we do have it available, but it is used for people in the hospital who have an oxygen requirement. And again, remdesivir is becoming more online for people to use, and it is part of national practice guidelines for hospitalized patients with COVID-19.
With an oxygen problem.
With an oxygen requirement, yes.
Yeah. Okay.
It's not something that is recommended for people as an outpatient or people who are on room air or who don't require oxygen.
Okay.
The second medication that he received also is part of the practice guidelines. And President Trump, it's reported that he did receive dexamethasone. Dexamethasone is a repurposed drug. It's not new. In clinical medicine, we use dexamethasone for all kinds of things. We use it as an anti-nausea medication in the oncology world. We use it for any anti-inflammatory property. Sometimes people get a medicine like dexamethasone for poison ivy. So dexamethasone was actually studied in Great Britain under the recovery trial. And unlike remdesivir, it showed that people who get dexamethasone have a lower mortality or a lower chance of dying from COVID-19 if they are admitted to the hospital and they have an oxygen requirement.
Hmm.
And the decrease in mortality or your decreased chance of dying is mostly seen in people who are on the breathing machine, but there also is a decreased mortality on anybody who's on any type of supplemental oxygen. And again, remdesivir and decadron are the two medications that are now part of national practice guidelines for hospitalized patients with COVID-19.
Okay. Now, then there is the unproven therapies. They said they gave him a dose of an experimental antibody cocktail not yet approved by the Food and Drug Administration.
That is correct. So President Trump, it's reported that he received a neutralizing monoclonal antibody. And I'll explain what that is. But earlier on in the disease process, what's being described for President Trump, it's more of a high viral load, high viral replication. So what these antibodies do, these are antibodies. They're actually made in a lab by a special species of mice. And they are programmed to make human antibodies. The antibodies are given to people who have a high viral load earlier on in the disease process. And all the antibodies do is bind the virus and essentially neutralize the virus and prevent the virus from infecting other cells. Now, what President Trump received was a neutralizing monoclonal antibody made by Regeneron. And Regeneron's neutralizing monoclonal antibody is actually two different neutralizing monoclonal antibodies. This particular medicine is not yet approved under emergency use authorization. It's still in phase 3 trials. And I could tell you at Riverside Methodist Hospital, we have a phase 3 trial with this particular agent. And these medications are also being studied and evaluated for outpatient use for people who are at risk with COVID-19 or even for high-risk people for prophylaxis if they have exposure to have somebody who has COVID-19. So President Trump got the medication under compassionate use. Compassionate use is not new for medicine. Mm-hmm. If somebody has a severe illness, as a physician, I'm able to contact a pharmaceutical company and say, hey, you have this drug that's still being studied, but given the dire circumstances of my patient, can I request that you release it to me for compassionate use in this particular patient? So those were convalescent. This type of neutralizing monoclonal antibody works the same way as how we've used convalescent plasma. And I think as time goes on, these neutralizing monoclonal antibodies will likely be approved under emergency use authorization. And I'm hopeful that we could use them more for an outpatient to keep people from coming in the hospital that are high risk.
Hmm. So do you have to be a certain level of sick to avail yourself of a compassionate use situation?
In most circumstances, yes. Now, the first two agents that he received, remdesivir and dexamethasone, the practice guidelines clearly state, obviously, there is an oxygen requirement, and these are medications that should be used in the hospital. Now, the use of the Regeneron neutralizing monoclonal antibody, they had to get it for compassionate use for the president. Now, when I have done compassionate use inquiries before for patients, it's usually people in the hospital who are very much in dire circumstances, and we want to really be as aggressive as we can on them if they're very sick.
Right. And the idea is it's still technically experimental, and this person might probably die without it, right?
That is correct. And again, you know, and it's human nature in medicine. If we have somebody who is very, very sick, we want to obviously think methodically about what we are doing, how we practice medicine. It's a craft of what we do. And if a doctor has consultation with other physicians and consultation with either the patient and their family, the best way to do it is to have that conversation and to make a decision where it's thought that the potential benefit would outweigh the risk. And of course, when this does happen, it's best done in the hospital because we want to monitor people for unintended consequences or side effects that may come up that we don't know about.
Now, of course, they can practically turn part of the West Wing into a hospital anyway. So when you send the president home, it's different than sending me home.
Absolutely. I'm sure the president probably has someone there taking his vital signs around the clock. And, you know, when people are on remdesivir in the hospital, they have to have daily blood work done. And even with dexamethasone, there are regular labs that you have to monitor to make sure there's no unintended consequences, whether it be a high blood sugar, changes in your potassium or other electrolytes. The golden rule in medicine is to do no harm. Mm-hmm. And again, that's something that I always think about every day when I see patients.
Now, with the dexamethasone, that's that steroid, high-powered steroid, usually only given to patients with more severe cases of the disease. What you said that there were side effects, and I know with steroids in general, sleeplessness can be one of them, right?
Oh, yeah, there's a whole bunch of them. Again, when it comes to these types of steroids in general, the side effects are kind of based on the dose.
Okay.
So giving higher doses are more prone to getting what we call lower doses. Now, what we use for COVID-19 is dexamethasone and 6 milligrams once a day for up to 10 days. And again, that's not really high dose steroid. However, you know, everybody reacts differently to medications. And I could tell you from prescribing this, I do see patients who do have side effects as if it is a high dose steroid. Mm. Now, let's go through some of the side effects. Some of the side effects for steroids and dexamethasone: high blood sugars, insomnia or difficulty sleeping. They can cause confusion. They can make you feel euphoric. They could do a lot of things with your mood, including feelings of sadness, depression, or even mania. But, you know, I've taken these types of treatments before myself. Last year, I had a bad case of poison ivy. Hmm. So I got a course of these types of medications, and it was difficult for me to sleep that night.
Yeah.
But again, we have to counsel patients and follow patients accordingly when they get these medications.
As far as, I mean, you can't just keep taking something like dexamethasone. It's not the sort of thing you keep taking, right?
That is correct. Long-term use of dexamethasone or other corticosteroids has a whole list of problems. They can suppress your adrenal system. They can prevent your production of cortisol. Long-term use does things to your skin. It could be associated with cataracts. Bruising. But for people who are on long-term steroids, it's easy for me to see them as a doctor because they have a particular look to them. They bruise easy. They have changes in their skin and their hair. But these medications, we use them appropriately when people need to have their immune system suppressed, such yeah. as a transplant patient. But long-term, these medications do have serious side effects.
And we're just about out of time, Dr. Gastaldo, but I wondered, what are you looking for? What are you watching for in the president's condition at this point?
Well, I don't know exactly what he's on at this point in time. You know, when people are in the hospital, we give them remdesivir. We give it to them for up to 5 days if they're not seriously ill. Sometimes people only get it for a couple days and they go home after getting 2 or 3 doses. Mm-hmm. That's okay. And the same thing, too, for Decadron. Typically, the standard treatment duration is 10 days, but we really don't know. Is he getting it for 3 days, 4 days, or 5 days? Mm-hmm. So I kind of want to see how he is looking, how he is talking. And President Trump is not out of the woods yet. You know, he's getting through the viral replication process of the disease.
Mm-hmm.
And for most people with a functioning immune system, that's okay. But some people do grow on to more inflammatory problems. Again, we'll have to wait and see. Right. Time will tell.
Well, Dr. Joe Gastaldo, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, man. Happy to be here.
It's Dr. Joe Gastaldo, practicing infectious diseases physician and medical director of infectious diseases at Ohio Health. That's it for Wellness Wednesday today. Thanks for joining us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.